If at first. My name is David Lanson, and I was with the Metropolitan Police for 27 years. When we got handed the Jensen case, I was a chief detective, heading up my own team. Not bad going. From outside, you'd think I was a standard careerist, ticking off the days until retirement. You'd be wrong. I'd grown to hate the job with a passion. Back when I signed on, the CID were real thief-takers. But by the time the Jensen case came up, I was spending all my time filling in risk assessment forms. I'm not kidding. The paperwork was beyond parody. All good stuff for lawyers, but we were getting hammered in the press for truly dismal crime statistics, and hammered by the politicians for not meeting their stupid targets. No wonder public confidence in us had reached rock bottom. The only useful thing we did for the average citizen by then was to hand out official crime numbers for insurance claims. I suppose that makes me sound bitter. But then that seems to be the fate of old men who are stuck in a job that's forever modernizing. The point of all this being, despite drowning in all that bureaucratic stupidity, I reckoned I was quite a decent policeman. That is, I know when people are lying. In those 27 years, I'd heard it all. And I do mean all. Desperate types who've made a mistake and then start spouting bollocks to cover themselves. The genuine nutters who live in their own little world and believe every word they're saying. Drunks and potheads trying to act sober. Losers with pitiful excuses. Real sick ones who are so cold and polite it makes my skin crawl. Listening to all that day in, day out, you soon learn to tell what's real and what isn't. So anyway, we get the call from Marcus Orthew's solicitor that his security people are holding an intruder at his Richmond Research Centre and they'd appreciate a full investigation of the situation. That was in 2007, and Orthew was a media and computer mogul then. At least that was the public perception. It wasn't until later I found out just how wide his commercial and technological interests were. His primary hardware company, Orthanix, had just started producing solid-state blocks that were generations ahead of anything the opposition was doing. They didn't have hard drives or individual components. The entire computer was wrapped up inside a single hyperprocessor. It wiped the floor with PCs and Apple Macs. He was always ahead of the game, Orthew. It was his original PCWs that blew Sinclair computers away at the start of the 80s. Everyone in my generation went and bought an Orthanix PCW as their first computer. But this break-in. I thought it was slightly odd, the solicitor calling me, rather than the company security office. Like I said, the longer you're in the game, you develop a feeling for these things. I took Paul Matthews and Carmen Galloway with me. They were lieutenants in my team. Good people, and slightly less bothered about all the paperwork flooding our office than me. Smart move, I guess. They'd probably make it further than I was ever destined to go. Orthanix Security were holding on to Toby Jensen. They'd found him breaking into one of the Richmond Centre labs, which the CCTV footage confirmed. And I was right. There was more to it. We read Toby Jensen his rights, and Uniform Division hauled him off. That was when the solicitor told me he was a stalker. A 24-carat obsessive. Marcus Orthew had known about him for years. Jensen had been following him round the globe, hacking into Orthew's systems, talking to people in his organisation, on his domestic staff, ex-girlfriends, basically anyone who crossed his path. But they hadn't been able to do anything about him. Jensen was smart. There was never any activity they could take him to court for. He never got physically close. All he did was talk to people. The hacking could never be proved in law. The Richmond break-in changed all that. As it was Orthew making the allegations, my boss told me to give it complete priority. I guess she was scared about what his magazines and satellite channels would do to the Met if we let it slide. I went out to Jensen's house with Paul and Carmen. Jesus, you should have seen the bloody place. I mean, it was out of a Hollywood serial killer film. Every room was filled with stuff on Orthew. Thousands of pictures taken all over the world. company press releases dating back decades, filing cabinets full of newspaper clippings, articles, every whisper of gossip, records of his movements, maps with his houses and factories on, copies of his magazines, tapes of interviews which Jensen had made, city financial reports on the company. It was a cross between a shrine and a Marcus Orthew museum. It spooked the hell out of me. No doubt about it. Jensen was totally fixated on Orthew. Forensics had to hire a removal lorry to clear the place out. I interviewed Jensen the next day, and that was when it started to get really weird. I'll tell you it as straight as I can remember, which is pretty much verbatim. I'm never ever going to forget that afternoon. First off, he wasn't upset that he'd been caught. More like resigned. Almost like a Premier League footballer who's lost the cup final. You know, it's a blow, but life goes on. The first thing he said was, "I should have realised. Marcus Orthew is a genius. He was bound to catch me out." Which is kind of ironic, really, isn't it? So I asked him what exactly he thought he'd been caught out doing. Get this. He said, "I was trying to find where he was building his time machine." Paul and Carmen just laughed at him. To them it was a sectioning case, pure and simple. Walk the poor bloke past the station doctor, get the certificate signed, lock him up in a padded room, and supply him with good drugs for the next 30 years. I thought more or less the same thing too. We wouldn't even need to go to trial. But we were recording the interview, and all his delusions would help coax a signature out of the doc. So I asked him what made him think Orthew was building a time machine. Jensen said they went to school together. That's how he knew. Now, the thing is, I checked this later, and they actually did go to some boarding school in Lincolnshire. Well, that's fair enough. Obsessions can start very early. Grudges, too. Maybe some fight over a bar of chocolate spiralled out of control, and it had been festering in Jensen's mind ever since. Jensen claimed otherwise. Marcus Orthew was the coolest kid in school, apparently. Didn't surprise me. From what I'd seen of him in interviews over the years, he was one of the most urbane men on the planet. Women found that very attractive. You didn't have to look through Jensen's press cuttings to know that. Orthew's girlfriends were legendary. Even the broadsheets reported them. So how on earth did Jensen decide that the coolest kid in school had evolved into someone building a time machine? "It's simple," he told us earnestly. "When I was at school, I got a cassette recorder for my 12th birthday. I was really pleased with it. Nobody else had one. Marcus saw it and just laughed. He snatched one of the cassettes off me, a C90, I remember, and he said, 'State of the art, huh? Damn, it's almost the same size as an iPod.'" Which didn't make a lot of sense to me. Paul and Carmen had given up by then, bored, waiting for me to wrap it up. "So?" I prompted. "So," Jensen said patiently, "this was 1972. Cassettes were state-of-the-art then. At the time I thought it was odd that iPod was some foreign word. Marcus was already fluent in 3 languages. He'd throw stuff like that at you every now and then, all part of his laid-back image. It was one of those things that lingers in your mind. There was other stuff too. The way he kept smiling every time Margaret Thatcher was on TV, like he knew something we didn't. When I asked him about it, he just said, 'One day you'll see the joke.' I've got a good memory, Detective, very good. All those little details kept adding up over the years. But it was the iPod which finally clinched it for me. How in God's name could he know about iPods back in 72? "Now I understand," I told him. "Time machine." Jensen gave me this look, like he was pitying me. "But Marcus was 12, just like me," he said. "We'd been at prep school together since we were 8, and he already possessed the kind of suavity men don't normally get until they're over 30. Damn it, he even unnerved the teachers. So how did an 8-year-old get to go time travelling? That was in 1968. NASA hadn't even reached the moon then. We'd only just got transistors. Nobody in 68 could build a time machine." But that's the thing with time machines, I told him. They travel back from the future. I knew I'd get stick from Paul and Carmen for that one, but I couldn't help it. Something about Jensen's attitude was bothering me, that old policeman's instinct. He didn't present himself as delusional. Okay, that's not a professional shrink's opinion, but I knew what I was seeing. Jensen was an ordinary, nerdish programmer, a self-employed contractor working from home. More recently from his laptop as he chased Orthew round the world. Something was powering this obsession. The more I heard, the more I wanted to get to the root of it. Exactly, Jensen said. His expression changed to tentative suspicion as he gazed at me. At first I thought an older Marcus had come back in time and given his young self a 2010 encyclopedia. It's the classic solution, after all, even though it completely violates causality. But knowledge alone doesn't explain Marcus's attitude. Something changed an ordinary little boy into a charismatic, confident, wise 50-year-old trapped in an 8-year-old body. And you worked out the answer, I guessed. Jensen produced a secretive smile. Information, he said. That's how he does it. That's how he's always done it. This is how it must have been first time round. Marcus grows up naturally and becomes a quantum theorist, a cosmologist, whatever. He's a genius, we know that. We also know you can't send mass back through time. Wormhole theory disallows it. You can't open a rift through time big enough to take an atom back a split second. The amount of energy to do that simply doesn't exist in the universe. So Marcus must have worked out how to send raw information instead, something that has zero mass. Do you see? He sent his own mind back to the 60s. All his memories, all his knowledge, packaged up and delivered to his earlier self. No wonder his confidence was off the scale. I had to send Paul out then. He couldn't stop laughing, which drew a hurt pout from Jensen. Carmen stayed, though she was grinning broadly. Jensen beat any of the current sitcoms on TV for chuckles. All right, then, I said. So Orthew sent his grown-up memory back to his kid self, and you're trying to find the machine that does it. Why is that, Toby? Are you kidding? He grunted. I want to go back myself. Seems reasonable, I admitted. Is that why you broke into the Richmond lab? Richmond was one of two possibles, he said. I've been monitoring the kind of equipment he's been buying for the last few years. After all, he's approaching 50. What's the relevance of that? Carmen interjected. He's a bloke, Jensen said. You must have read the gossip about him and girls. There have been hundreds, models, actresses, society types. That always happens with rich men, she told him. You can't base an allegation on that, especially not the one you're making. Yes, but the first time round he was just a physicist, Jensen said. There's no glamour or money in that. Now, though, he knows how to build every post-2000 consumer item at age 8. He can't not be a billionaire. This time round he was worth 100 million by the time he was 20. With that kind of money you can do anything you want. And I think I know what that is. You only have to look at his genetics division. His electronics are well in advance of anything else on the planet, but what his labs are accomplishing with DNA sequencing and stem cell research are phenomenal. They have to have started with a baseline of knowledge decades ahead of anybody else. Next time he goes back, he'll introduce the techniques he's developed this time round into the 1970s. We'll probably have rejuvenation by 1990. Think what that'll make him, a time-travelling immortal. I'm not going to miss out on that if I can help it. I don't get it, I told him. If Orthew goes back and gives us all immortality in the 90s, you'll be a part of it. We all will. Why go to these criminal lengths? I don't know if it is time travel, Jensen said forlornly. Not actual travelling backwards. I still don't see how he gets round causality. It's more likely he kicks sideways. I don't get that, I said. What do you mean? A parallel universe, Jensen explained. Almost identical to this one. Generating the wormhole might actually allow for total information transfer. The act of opening it creates a Xerox copy of this universe as it was in 1967. Maybe. I'm not certain what theory his machine is based on, and he certainly isn't telling anyone. I looked at Carmen. She just shrugged. Okay, thank you for your statement, I told Jensen. We'll talk again later. You don't believe me, he accused me. Obviously, we'll have to run some checks, I replied.
Tape 83-7B, he growled at me. That's your proof. And if it isn't at the Richmond Center, then he's building it at Ealing. Check there if you want the truth.
Which I did. Not immediately. While Carmen and Paul sorted out Jensen's next interview with the criminal psychologist, I went down to forensics. They found the videotape labelled 83-7B for me, which had a big red star on the label. It was a recording of a kids' show from 83, Saturday Breakfast with Bernie. Marcus Orthew was on it to promote his Nanox computer, which was tied into a national school computer learning syllabus for which Orthanix had just won the contract. It was the usual zany rubbish, with minor celebrities being dunked in blue and purple goo at the end of their slot. Marcus Orthew played along like a good sport. But it was what happened when he came out from under the dripping nozzle which sent a shiver down my spine. Wiping the goo off his face, he grinned and said, "That's got to be the start of reality TV." In 1983... It was Orthew's satellite channel which inflicted Big Brother on us in 1995. Toby Jensen's computer contained a vast section on the Orthanix Ealing facility. 8 months ago, it had taken delivery of 12 specialist cryogenic superconductor cells. The power rating was higher than the ones used by Boeing's shiny new electro-ramjet spaceplane. I spent a day thinking about it, while the interview with Toby Jensen played over and over in my mind. In the end, it was my gut police instinct I went with. Toby Jensen had convinced me. I put my whole so-called career on the line and applied for a warrant. I figured out later that was where I went wrong. Guess which company supplied and maintained the Home Office IT system? The request must have triggered red rockets in Orthew's house. According to the security guards at the gate, Marcus Orthew arrived 12 minutes before us. Toby Jensen had thoughtfully indicated, in his files, the section he believed most suitable to be used for the construction of a time machine. He was right, and I'd been right about him. The machine was like the core of the CERN accelerator, a warehouse packed full of high-energy physics equipment. Right at the centre, with all the fat wires and conduits and ducts focusing on it, was a dark spherical chamber with a single oval opening. The noise screeching out from the hardware set my teeth on edge. Paul and Carmen clamped their hands over their ears. Then Carmen pointed and screamed. I saw a giant brick of plastic explosive strapped to an electronics cabinet. Now I knew what to look for. I saw others. Some were sitting on the superconductor cells. So that's what it's like being caught inside an atom bomb. Marcus Orthew was standing inside the central chamber. Sort of. He was becoming translucent. I yelled at the others to get out and ran for the chamber. I reached it as he faded from sight. Then I was inside. My memories started to unwind, playing back my life, very fast. I only recognized tiny sections amid the blur of color and emotion. The high-speed chase that nearly killed me, the birth of my son, Dad's funeral, the church where I got married, university. Then the playback started to slow, and I remembered that day when I was about 11, in the park, when Kenny Mattox, our local bully, sat on my chest and made me eat the grass cuttings. I spluttered as the soggy mass was pushed down past my teeth, crying out in shock and fear. Kenny laughed and stuffed some more grass in. I gagged and started to puke violently. Then he was scrambling off in disgust. I lay there for a while, getting my breath back and spitting out grass. I was 11 years old, and it was 1968. It wasn't the way I'd choose to arrive in the past, but in a few months, Neil Armstrong would set foot on the moon, then the Beatles would break up. What I should have done, of course, was patented something. But what? I wasn't a scientist or even an engineer. I can't tell you the chemical formula for Viagra. I didn't know the mechanical details of an airbag. There were everyday things I knew about, icons that we can't survive without, the kind which rake in millions. But would you like to try selling a venture capitalist the idea of Lara Croft 5 years before the first pocket calculator hits the shops? I did that. I was actually banned from some banks in the city. So I fell back on the easiest thing in the world. I became a singer-songwriter. Songs are ridiculously easy to remember, even if you can't recall the exact lyrics. Remember my first big hit in 78? Shiny, Happy People? I always was a big REM fan.
You've never heard of them?
Oh, well, sometimes I wonder what the band members are doing this time around. Pretty in Pink, Teenage Kicks, The Unforgettable Fire, Salisbury Hill. They're all the same. That fabulous oeuvre of mine isn't quite as original as I make out. And I'm afraid Live Aid wasn't actually the flash of inspiration I always said either. But the music biz has given me a bloody good life. Every album I've released has been number one on both sides of the Atlantic. That brings in money. A lot of money. It also attracts girls. I mean, I never really believed the talk about backstage excess in the time I had before. But trust me here, the public never gets to hear the half of it. I thought it was the perfect cover. I've been employing private agencies to keep an eye on Marcus Orthew since the mid-70s. Several of his senior management team are actually on my payroll. Hell, I even bought shares in Orthogene. I knew it was going to make money, though I didn't expect quite so much money. I can afford to do whatever the hell I want. And the beauty of that is nobody pays any attention to rock stars or how we blow our cash. Everyone thinks we're talentless, junked-up kids heading for a fall. That's what you think has happened now, isn't it? The fall. Well, you're wrong about that. See, I made exactly the same mistake as poor old Toby Jensen. I underestimated Marcus. I didn't think it through. My music made ripples, big ripples. Everyone knows me. I'm famous right across the globe as a one-off super talent. There's only one other person in this time who knows those songs aren't original. Marcus. He knew I came after him. And he hasn't quite cracked the rejuvenation treatment yet. It's time for him to move on, to make his fresh start again in another parallel universe. That's why he framed me. Next time around, he's going to become our god. It's not something he's going to share with anyone else. I looked around the interview room, which had an identical layout to the grubby cube just down the hall where I interviewed Toby Jensen last time around. Paul Matthews and Carmen Galloway were giving me blank-faced looks, buttoning back their anger at being dragged into the statement. I couldn't quite get used to Paul with a full head of hair, but Orthogene's follicle treatment is a big earner for the company. Everyone in this universe uses it. I tried to bring my hands up to them, an emphasis to the appeal I was making, but the handcuffs were chained to the table. I glanced down as the metal pulled at my wrists. After the samples had been taken, the forensics team had washed the blood off my hands. But I couldn't forget it. There'd been so much. The image was actually stronger than the one I kept of Toby Jensen. Yet I'd never seen those girls until I woke up to find their bodies in the hotel bed with me. The paramedics didn't even try to revive them. "Please," I implored. "Paul, Carmen, you have to believe me." And I couldn't even say, "For old time's sake."